In 25 minutes, the average person speaks 3,450 words. In that amount of time, you can learn about a person, their accomplishments, a cause, or how to improve your life. You can have a better understanding of the world we live in, meet people who you've never heard of, engage marvelous stories, ideas, and thoughts for you. I'm Joe Dobzinski, and this is 3450. Journalist Beth Macy has covered the opioid crisis as a reporter, involving herself with addicts trying to get clean. She has seen families grieving from overdose deaths. She has had discussions with heroin dealers, read drug studies, and paged through court documents. Yet through the journey, still finds the reason to be helpful with those facing addiction or attempting to build a better life and a better future for themselves and their family. Her new book, Dope Sick, Dealers, Doctors, and the Drug Companies That Addicted America, attempts to capture the size of the crisis. Welcome to the 3450, Beth.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So, 20-plus years struggle we've had with opioid addiction. How did it go from small communities to in central Appalachia to wealthy suburbs?
Yeah, so it starts out in these distressed communities because the pharmaceutical company Purdue, when they launched OxyContin, targeted areas where there were already people taking painkillers, and those tended to be in areas where there were workplace injuries, coal mining, fishing, logging, et cetera. And I argue in the book, because these were rural, politically unimportant places, rest of America got to sort of ignore it, right? Our regional media, for instance, no longer covered the coal fields where I'm based out of Virginia. And we just kind of let it go as an othering, if you will. And then when heroin lands, and I tell the story through three different kinds of communities in Virginia, when heroin lands in the cities and the suburbs, and I focus my book on here in Roanoke, Virginia, where I live, it's a city of about 250,000, and it really kind of settles in this upper middle class neighborhood, it also was just sort of easy to ignore because the kids had the money to hide their habits. And the parents who were in on the quote, dirty little secret, would send their kids off to rehab. And they were so ashamed because of the stigma that they didn't tell their neighbors. And so you see sort of a double whammy of how this epidemic was allowed to fester and grow for so long. It didn't really start capturing the national media's attention with heroin. You know, the pills got hard to get in the late aughts, and OxyContin was reformulated in 2010. Didn't really turn into a heroin crisis that we knew about anyways until, I mean, you weren't starting to read about it until like 2014 or 15. So that's a long time for a drug epidemic to sort of get slapped in.
Wasn't oxycodone, though, aggressively marketed as an addiction-free painkiller and also as an ADHD medication?
Not an ADHD medication. It's OxyContin, and it came out in 1996. And yes, it was very aggressively marketed as being only addictive in, quote, less than 1% of cases. I have a coffee mug here on my desk that they gave out to the doctors that says OxyContin logo on one side, and on the other side it says the one to start with, the one to stay with. Like, they wanted you to be on it for a long time, and they told you that because it had this brand new 12-hour time-release mechanism that it was less prone to addiction and abuse. And of course, we know now that wasn't correct. The important thing to remember is that FDA allowed them to make this sort of vague disclaimer that because of this new brand new time-lapse mechanism, it was believed to reduce the liability of abuse. And then Purdue's marketing people sort of, and their sales rep, made that claim a certainty and hired doctors to be paid spokesmen and et cetera, et cetera.
So they're kind of a greed and need type mentality.
Yeah.
So how does it stay so firmly entrenched in our society?
Well, as I said before, I think the stigma, like I think a lot of people didn't want to talk about the fact that this was going on in our families and in our neighborhoods. I also think it was a long time before doctors, you know, the CDC only in 2016 came out with these guidelines that we shouldn't immediately start with opioids. which that's like, duh, for 100 years, we only used opioids for severe pain, end of life, cancer pain. And then Purdue and a bunch of other opioid lobbying groups and pain is a fifth vital sign sort of flipped the narrative in the mid-90s. And now you're seeing that narrative flip back almost too far the other way. People with severe pain are now having trouble getting their opioids. And I hear from a lot of readers that, you know, this too is wrong and we need to approach it all with nuance. But I firmly believe, and my book argues, that the doctors, you know, many of whom became paid spokesmen for this company, many of whom accepted free meals, OxyContin branded beach hats, coffee mugs like the one on my desk, should feel morally compelled to help us get out of this crisis. And by that, I don't mean just stopping people from their painkillers that they're taking, but I mean becoming part of the treatment complement, becoming waivered to prescribe buprenorphine, which is the medication-assisted treatment that study after study shows is the best for reducing relapse and overdose death. And many don't want to become waivered to prescribe it because they, you know, they say it's cumbersome, but I think there's a lot of stigma attached there. I think doctors are reluctant. They don't want to have, quote, addicts in their waiting rooms, when actually, look around, they already have, quote, addicts in their waiting rooms.
So I guess the thing is as I look at this and read the book, there was like high school, like football, sports people. I mean, it had to go back to the coaches giving it to them, right? It wasn't so much the pain, but the pain was being prescribed. The solution was being prescribed by doctors that were related to the coaches, maybe?
No, I don't think the coaches. I think mostly it was, let's take Jesse Ballstridge. The book begins with a mother at her son's grave. He's a 19-year-old former football star. He had a bunch of genuine injuries and snowboarding, football injuries. She doesn't know exactly the moment he got addicted because he was able to hide it. One of the things he did was he had been prescribed Ritalin as a young boy. And then once he got addicted to opioids from his sports injuries, he started trading his Adderall and Ritalin for harder stuff that were opioids. And again, this was all to stave off. He was already addicted. He didn't want to become dope sick, or he didn't want to experience the feeling of withdrawal, which addicts say, or users say, is the worst, like the worst flu times 100. And so before she knew it, you know, or she didn't actually know it, she thought he was, quote, just doing pills, but he was, when the pills got hard to get, he was then buying heroin off the street and initially snorting it, just like he had snorted the pills. And then before long, because he's getting dope sick again, because he needs a stronger hit, he's injecting it. And that's pretty much the narrative of what I heard over and over again with young people who started out taking the pills got harder to get, then they transitioned to heroin, because we have to remember, they're like chemical cousins. They both are morphine-derived drugs. So OxyContin and heroin, very similar. And if you're addicted to OxyContin, then you can no longer get your OxyContin. If you take heroin, it's going to give you that same feeling, and more importantly, it's going to stave off that feeling of dope sickness. So that's what's happening. And more recently, because it has fentanyl in it, which is so much stronger than even heroin, that's what's sort of infecting the supply, and that's why we're seeing overdose deaths not even begin to go down.
When you talk about high school, and you know, it seems like high school seems to be a starting point in some degree, whether it's sports or just, you know, injuries that you did from sports. Is it true that, I mean, in your book you mentioned, I think, about standouts, you know, falling prey to prostitution, jails, and deaths, and some of that is the pain of being just joblessness and paying bills. Is that still pretty much the reasoning for people being involved with OxyContin?
Yeah, I mean, in the early years, especially in the rural communities where the jobs were going away, the coal mines were closing, the factories were shutting down, people were self-medicating their psychic pain in addition to their physical pain, as well as some people were doctor shopping or getting multiple prescriptions or coaching their neighbor to get a prescription that perhaps she didn't really need. And then they were selling it. And OxyContin was going for about a dollar a milligram on the street. And so it became its own resource to be plundered, like in the way moonshine would be sort of a side hustle in the older days, right? People were selling their OxyContin that if they were on Medicaid, they could get for like a dollar with their Medicaid card and then make thousands of dollars selling it on the black market. With heroin, it's with people from the upper middle class communities, it comes along a little bit later, I say in the mid to late aughts, but it's the same story once this drug has its hooks in you. I follow a young woman from a very well-off family. Her dad's a surgeon. Her mom's a hospital nurse. Grew up with a vacation home on Bobhead Island. I mean, every seeming advantage that you would want, private school. And once she becomes addicted, initially through prescribed opioids, she eventually, just as I described earlier, transitions to heroin. She's living homeless on the street. She's not being able to get medication-assisted treatment due to a variety of factors that we can talk about later. Before long, she's prostituting. She's involved in criminal gangs. And she ends up murdered. Her murder remains unsolved. She was murdered after she failed out of a rehab, an abstinence-only rehab in Las Vegas. She ends up in the bottom of a dumpster in Las Vegas on Christmas Eve. Now, tell me that's the kind of ending for a story that you imagine for a young woman that seems to have everything going for her.
Yeah, it's a terrible situation. Did you find that parents who had lost family members or had addictions in their family were willing to open up to you? And why do you think that, instead of just keeping it to themselves?
I think because there's been so much press about it, and parents who have been in the trenches for a long time. I mean, a lot of parents, by the time I showed up on the scene, they had been dealing with this addiction for years and years, and they're just fed up. Like they realize now they can no longer hide what's going on. In order for the government to take this seriously, in order for the communities to start embracing treatment and harm reduction services, they're going to have to tell their stories. And so you see a lot of brave people now stepping out and telling their stories, as opposed to when I first started writing about heroin in the suburb back in 2012, it was very hard to get people to go on the record. They were still sort of cloaked in stigma and shame. Now you have more people willing to step out because perhaps their child is dead and they're doing it to honor their child. Perhaps their child has been in recovery for some years and they're doing it as a way to sort of pay back, you know, as a way to give thanks for their child still being alive. They're doing it because they're civic-minded people and they know it's the right thing to do. I will say that people who are on medication-assisted treatment, buprenorphine and methadone, are still stigmatized a lot. They're not welcome largely in abstinence-only 12-step meetings. And there's a big divide about that still. I think it's the number one stumbling block. So at the end of my book, I write about some real success stories of people who've been on buprenorphine for years, have gotten their kids back, have gotten their jobs back, are really doing well, almost like a diabetic managing their diabetes with insulin. They're still taking it. It's been a number of years. They are still prone to relapse if they get off of it. So this is a lifetime thing in some cases. The science isn't clear on how long these people should be on these maintenance drugs. But it is clear that if they stay on, they're much less likely to relapse or die. And many people are still afraid. Like several of the people, there was one woman getting off disability at the end of the book, and she didn't want me to use her name. And so that's got to be the next front that we tackle in this, is really getting people on board with medication-assisted treatment.
Well, that brings me to another question. So how do you think the federal government is responding to this crisis under the current administration?
I think they're giving a lot of sort of flashy headlines and then not much follow-up. I think, you know, President Trump said he was going to declare it a national emergency. He declared it something else that sounded like a national emergency. He declared it a public health emergency, which released no new funds or authority. So that was a big nothing. I think, you know, the drug czar office still hasn't been filled. We need leadership at every level. It, depending on where you are in this country, if you're in Massachusetts and you have a child who's sadly addicted, you can send them to a rehab facility. And if that rehab facility takes Medicaid or Medicare, they are by law required to allow people to be on MAT. In Virginia, almost no treatment facilities allow that. So, I mean, if I had an addicted child, I might perhaps move to Massachusetts. There's still 17 states that haven't passed the Medicaid expansion. That allows people to get access to substance abuse services. We need federal leadership to sort of say, hey, this is our view of what works. We need to make this happen in every state. And then conversely, like going down from there, where you are in Virginia matters if you have harm reduction services. There's only one little town in far southwest Virginia that's been managed to open a syringe exchange and recovery program because the state law requires that the police sign off, and the police will not sign off here in Roanoke where I live. I'm actually having a meeting about it tomorrow. And so what's needed to bring these disparate groups not collaborating with each other together is leadership at every level.
You know, you mentioned that we've lost probably more than 300,000 Americans in 15 years of drug overdose. Do you see this? In your journey, in the research, is there a worldwide crisis out there with this as well?
Well, Americans sort of leading it. We consume about a third of the world's opioids, mm-hmm. or the oxycodone-based products. I've read that Purdue Pharma's worldwide subsidiaries are now sort of going into developing countries with this whole notion, again, just like they did in the 90s, that pain is being undertreated. So there's a great piece in Foreign Affairs, if your readers or listeners want to check that out, about just sort of this is now they're exporting this wave of addiction. And so look out. Countries in Western Europe are far more ahead of us in terms of harm reduction, in terms of giving access to medication-assisted treatment. And you know, these are countries that have socialized medicine. But look at France, for instance, which removed the waiver requirement for doctors to be able to prescribe buprenorphine in the 80s in response to a heroin crisis there. And they expanded their capacity by 10 and reduced their overdose deaths by 87%. So there are some great models, and even, you know, Portugal decriminalized drugs, put a lot of money that they were putting into law enforcement and incarceration into treatment instead, and have the lowest rate of overdose death in Europe. So there are a lot of models out there. It's just a matter of, as a country, are we willing to take a look at them?
Is it because, you know, a lot of the countries you were talking about are not as large as the United States? Is it because of the size of the United States that's making it difficult to get control?
I don't know if it's the size as much as it is this idea that, you know, the government shouldn't step in and help people. I mean, this is still a nation where many people don't have basic health care. And in Western Europe, they do. They've said that's a priority. And, you know, we're still fighting about the Affordable Care Act here. I think it's more an issue of that than size.
So in your journey of research on this subject, did you find anything or any kind of heavy use of the drug in the military?
No, I didn't really get into that too much. I mean, I've certainly heard a lot of cases of VAs overprescribing veterans when they got back, military wives being overprescribed. No, the people I was following were basically kind of local kids who had gotten ensnared. And, you know, I chose to tell the story because it was just so dark. I worked on this full time for about 2.5 years. It was just so dark. I chose to write the story through the people in each of the three localities that I featured who were fighting back. And so those were like a country doctor in rural Appalachia, a group of mothers trying to implement, divert people from jail instead of treatment here in Roanoke. And then in in this farm town that I wrote about where a drug dealer landed, and they, all of a sudden they had a big heroin problem. I featured the law enforcement people that were fighting back. I did not happen to cross paths with the military, and I wasn't able to investigate the BA for this book. I felt there was, you know, so much to cover already.
I have to ask you this because, you know, was there a time when you were collecting information and talking to families like that you really were at a point of wanting to go face to face with the administration now and say, what are you doing?
I mean, I get asked in interviews, just like you just asked me a bit. I'm sort of, it's a national disgrace. I'm outraged. I've actually just been invited to go speak before the drug czar's office to the employees. I mean, it'll be an off the record thing where I share and hopefully they'll share. And, you know, maybe I can help inform the public, but I just think this opioid epidemic is taken advantage of any little weakness in our social fabric, and particularly the gaps between healthcare and criminal justice are so wide and they're so far apart. I mean, it's like they're operating on different planets, and the opioid crisis just like seeps into that gap. And that's why I say we need leadership from the very top down to our local police chiefs and our local drug courts, our local city managers, our governors, our state boards, the community service boards. I mean, we had a community service board director here who wasn't allowing MAT. And that's just, you know, that's a bureaucratic issue. His boss at the state level finally figured that out. And now they're changing their policy, but everybody's got to do their job, right? I mean, that's been frustrating to me. I mean, just because you've maybe seen a bad experience with somebody on MAT doesn't mean it's not going to work for the majority of people. Study after study says it does. And so why should we let this, I call it an observation bias in the book. You know, I had a judge friend of mine say, well, I'm not going to allow my probationers to be on MAT because they'll just sell it. They'll just sell their Suboxone and buy methamphetamine. And I said, you're not seeing the people who are using it correctly. You're just seeing the examples. And it's not a perfect drug, but it's still the best drug that we have right now. It's the best tool in the toolbox.
Your book's mind-shattering on the crisis that's involved right now, even though the press carries a lot of it. It doesn't get in depth as your book did. What are you hoping will be your continued goal with the book?
Yeah, so I keep, I have this locket I wear when I go out and speak about it that Tess Henry's mom, she's the woman that was murdered on Christmas Eve that I talked about earlier. Her mom gave me this locket, and I put a picture of Tess on one side, and the locket has an inscription of a poem that Tess loved that reminded her of the love she feels for her son. And so it's important to her mother, and she has a matching one. And so I keep a picture of Tess on one side, and I keep a picture of James Baldwin on the other, because James Baldwin, who's just awesome, said, not everything that's faced can be changed, but nothing can be changed until it's faced. And I think my book makes the rare contribution in that it tells the entire story of the opioid crisis up to now. It starts with OxyContin, then it goes to heroin, and then to fentanyl. And it deals with criminal justice, the gaps in the healthcare system. It is, I think it's the only complete book on the crisis. And I'm hoping that it helps people not just understand how we got here, but how we're going to get out of it. And I hope it mobilizes people to care. And that's why I sort of keep James Baldwin there in that locket as my lodestar.
Beth Macy has been our guest today on 3450. Her new book, Dope Sick Dealers, Doctors, and the Drug Company That Addicted America, is an outstanding book in regards to things that you need to know about what's really going on behind the scenes. Beth, it's been a pleasure having you on the show today, and good luck with the book.
Thank you so much.